Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 17 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and different guests look through the 1973 cult classic horror film The Wicker Man one section at a time. I'm joined on this week's episode by David Brook. David, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you very much. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, pleasure to be here on probably one of the hottest days of the year in the UK.
Yeah, it is. I am quite sweaty in my little box room.
kind of fitting for, given what's the ending of the theme section we're going to talk about, that it's a pretty warm day today.
Yeah, very fitting.
So yeah, episode 17. So just before we dive into the film, scene in question from the last bit, how we're getting anointed and prepared for his sacrifice. Yeah, how he's railing against the people of Summerall, saying that his sacrifice, it won't bring back their apples. That's the reason why everything is failing, is that the strains of fruit that were developed by Lord Summerall's grandfather had failed. But then the residents of Summerall also saying that what they're trying to do, how he is, in their way, an honour, giving him a martyr's death, and that he should be grateful in a way that he's being treated that way and being sacrificed. And after all that, we get the big moment of this scene, the actual reveal of the Wicker Man and true horror of the film properly coming into play, whereas how he's dragged to the Wicker Man, put inside it, locked in, and see how he, do another rant against the residents of Summerall, calling on, saying that, see how this god that has laid waste to their orchards, and the scene ending with Lord Summerall giving the order for the Wicker Man to be set on fire. So, before we dive into this section of the film, David, what is your general history with The Wicker Man?
Well, I kind of first saw it, I've only seen it twice, including my recent rewatch for this, so it's not one I know really well. It's a film I watched first quite late on as well. I saw it, I want to say 10 years ago maybe, and I watched it on, I was actually working away, and I was staying in a grotty little hotel, and I'd brought some DVDs with me, and I brought The Wicker Man. It was one of these free with the newspaper kind of DVDs, so it wasn't great quality. I think it might have been 4:3 kind of stuff, and it's and I watched it and I liked it. I thought it was pretty good, but it didn't really blow me away. I was a bit slightly disappointed by it. But I liked bits of it, and I did find especially the ending very powerful. So, but I'm glad you called me onto the podcast though, because I've kind of been wanting to rewatch it in a better kind of situation. So now this time I'd bought the Blu-ray. I think just a couple of weeks before you invited me to do the podcast, I was like, oh yeah, perfect. And this time it was the Blu-ray, it was a remastered one, and I watched the Final Cut, the Final Cut? So the kind of director approved kind of version, and I watched it on my projector in HD, and so I got a proper kind of almost cinema experience. And and this time round, it was interesting. What I found watching it again, I liked it a lot more this time, definitely. But I must admit, I don't find it that scary. The ending is kind of brutal and horrific, but the rest of the film I don't find that scary. But, and I think that's why initially I was a little bit oh, I don't know, I wasn't quite sure about the film. But I think what I've found now is there's so much more to it. I think I find the film fascinating. I find it very clever and very interesting now. Even if as a horror film, I don't think it's that particularly terrifying. I find its view of religion very interesting, the way it kind of contrasts Christianity, obviously in the Howie character is very a devout Christian, and it counters his beliefs with those of the islanders. An interesting thing that I found watching this way round, I think another reason why I didn't find it that scary is I really sided with the islanders this time round. And watching some of the extra features on the Blu-ray, I think a lot of other people are in the same boat. Which is why this time, actually, the finale, although it's still disturbing, it's almost, I wouldn't say a happy ending, but part of me is Howie's a bit of a knob. It's he kind of deserves a bit of a comeuppance. He's so against all of their beliefs and their kind of way of life. And to be honest, other than the sacrifices, their way of life's pretty idyllic. It's pretty, they're a bit maybe overly frank about sex in front of kids and stuff, which probably I wouldn't go that far, but it's a bit more of like a hippie ideal. It's all about life and the earth and stuff like that, and kind of nature, which, I don't know, to me it's like, I'm an atheist, I'm not a Christian, and I've kind of fairly strong views about religions, and I think part of that really hit me this time, and I kind of, how much I kind of liked the islanders' way of life before they started killing people, obviously, and how I was kind of siding with them. So I had a really weird experience this time, but I appreciate the film a lot more, and I thought it was, I think it's a great film. I just don't think it's a particularly scary horror film, but I don't think it has to be.
Yeah, that's something that's kept cropping up in this podcast, is that it's not really a horror film. It has, the ending is a proper great horror scene, but like the rest of the film, like most of the first half, it plays more like a murder mystery, and then we get the philosophical religious debates in the middle, and I mean, I'm quite one of the old people who view it as a musical, given how much songs in it. It's one where it really is hard to describe exactly what tone the Wicker Man is, how best to categorize it, and because it feels like it's because of the power of the ending that led to it being classed as a horror film. But yeah, doing calling it a horror film, it just doesn't quite feel right, given just how offbeat and weird and unique the whole tone of the film is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of a kind, really. Some films have tried to copy it. There are other kind of folk horrors that are definitely influenced by it, but few of them have that same kind of feel. Definitely the music's a big thing. And the music's one of these things, when it first starts singing, it's a bit off-putting. It's like, oh, it's a bit jarring, and it kind of shows the film's age a little bit. But once you get into it, once you get used to it and get in the swing of it, and I think it depends what cut you see. I think some of them have fewer songs, and I think the final cut has quite a few songs, and I think, in a way, although the songs are a bit weird when they first appear, the more they're used in that cut, the more you kind of attune to them and appreciate why they're there and how it fits into showing this idyllic, hippie-like kind of communal atmosphere. And I really liked the music this time. And I'm glad, actually, that the Blu-ray set I got actually comes with the soundtrack. Which
I've got that. That's it. Well, not the Blu-ray, but I have got the DVD of it. And so, I've got the soundtrack on that CD, and I've got it on vinyl.
Yeah, oh, nice.
Saying, it's more often than that, I do listen to the soundtrack fairly regularly.
Nice.
Actually, something else you talk about, just interesting, is that it was one of those, when you first watched it, it was in one of those, like, DVD with a newspaper type things. And it's because this is pretty much the last film I'd expect to be in one of those deals.
it was really bizarre. I'm almost certain it was a free newspaper one of those little sleeve things.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the newspaper was, but it was a bizarre film to shove with a free with the newspaper.
Because, I usually, remember, when I was growing up, and quite a few times going round to my granddad's house, and he was subscribed to those papers like the Daily Mail and the Express that regularly did those features, and from my memory, it used to be all period dramas or old black and white public domain, the Ealing comedies, stuff like that.
Carry on films. I think you see a lot of carry on
films. Yeah, loads of carry on. Or ones I do episodes of stuff like Inspector Morse or those old murder mystery shows. Especially given the content of The Wicker Man.
Yeah, and plus it's an 18. I think it is. I assume it is.
It's been definitely when I at the time of recording, I went to see it in the cinema night before we do this recording, and definitely now it's been rated 15 by the BBC. But yeah. I'm guessing it was one of the ones where for a while it was being the equivalent of in a 15 or an 18 when it was first released, and up until those ratings actually into effect by BBFC.
Yeah, because there's a fair amount of nudity in it, so it probably would have been an X back then.
Was it AA, the equivalent of the 15?
Oh, I'm not sure. I want to say X, but that might be more an 18 thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was X and then AA, because I definitely remember AA was rating given to Life of Brian when I was watching documentaries about that. Well, it's wrong because, again, as films in the newspapers, ones that I watch, it's usually got to, a 12 at the highest. It's usually more U or PG.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those ones, because sometimes I think he had to kind of ask behind the counter or something to get the disc or something, maybe. I don't know. It's a bit weird. Yeah, it'd be surprised. Yeah, I'm just looking on IMDb. According to this, its original rating was X.
Yeah.
So, and in 1990, it was still an 18. So, yeah, but definitely surprised to just work in a newspaper. I'm pretty certain it was, unless it was one free with, a film magazine or something. But I'm pretty sure it was, a Daily Mail. Or, no, it's a Telegraph or Guardian or something.
Yeah, that makes more sense if it's one of those papers, one of the more, what is it, called the broadsheets, those type of ones.
Yeah, yeah. I actually remember, I've actually got a couple at home of VHS tapes that came free with newspaper or the magazine. And those were, because they're so big and clunky. It was the crazy, I can't remember if I had to send off them. I don't think so. I think, again, it's behind the counter. I can remember getting Metropolis, the silent movie that came with, it's one of the first issues. Oh, yeah.
How many videos would that have been?
Oh, I don't know. It was with Total Film. I think it was one of the earliest Total Films when it just came out. I don't know. I want to say, how old am I now? I want to say it would have been in the, it was when videos were kind of on the wane. I think it's why they were giving it away free. But it was,
mid-90s transition from VHS to DVD.
Yeah, it was mid to late 90s, I thought. I got that. A deep cover I got with the newspaper once. I got a few. But anyway, we're going off on a bit of a tangent. But it's not really a thing anymore. It doesn't really happen anymore. I guess everything's streaming anyway. But
Yeah. I mean, even then, actually talk about quality. Not just, quality of the image, but the actual quality of the disc itself. I remember, I think it was, the Neil Diamond remake of The Jazz Singer.
Oh, yeah.
Where the disc was so thin, you could pretty much just, breeze would snap it in half.
Yeah, they were always the worst transfer they could find, and it was always really dodgy. I've still got a heap of them, because I'm a terrible, I just hoard and hoard and hoard. And I can remember picking up at a charity shop, they had, just a box full of them, and I was like, yeah, I'll have that. It was about £3 or something. I've got dozens of, I think it had the entire World at War series gradually over many discs.
Oh, that was definitely a good staple. anyway, a bit of a tangent, but these same tangents are what this podcast lives on. So, yeah, actually getting into this seeding question. So, actually going back to the religious, so we get that at the start of this scene is more of the religious ideology conflict between Howie and the Islanders. And also in terms of how the tone, how Howie and the Islanders presents it, we've got Howie railing against the Islanders. You've got that reverb and echo when he's denouncing them in the name of Christ. Mm. Whereas especially Christopher Lee's performance, he's just really calm, genial. He's just very. It's one of the ways that you can kind of feel like this is a more ideal religion, is the way Lee presents it and sells it, compared to how he's got this whole bluster and anger over I think his demands that they have to be Christian.
Yeah, his character is, because Howie's so kind of buttoned up through most of the film, and this is where he kind of turns, I guess, around this, maybe the previous 5 minutes, but he kind of finally breaks and loses his kind of demeanor, and he's just ranting with his religious rantings. And as you say, Christopher Lee's the opposite, which is unusual. You expect Christopher Lee in what some people class as a horror movie, you expect him to be doing his big grand. I guess he has a few moments towards the end, but he's, as you say, he does have a bit of a change in this scene though, I think, earlier in the film. Earlier in the film he is very relaxed and calm, but he's much sterner in this final sequence. But he's still relatively subdued, especially compared to maybe some of his showier kind of horror roles in the Hammer movies and things.
Especially compared to his roles as Dracula, or he played the Frankenstein monster, if I'm remembering right, in one of the Peter Cushing Frankenstein films.
Oh yeah, I've not seen that, but yeah, I think so.
But yeah, you kind of expect him to be this more grandiose, over the top figure. Whereas here it feels probably one of his more normal roles that was the burning.
Yeah, I think that's partly why, because he's always really championed the film, hasn't he? He's always claimed it's one of his best performances, and I think it's partly because it's given him something different to do. He got so typecast in these Hammer movies for a long, long time, and this gives him something a lot more interesting to work with, really. And he kind of really got it and understood that it wasn't just a kind of a
rote horror film.
Yeah, rote horror film, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, was so it's like Lee not taking a paycheck, working for doing it for free, and doing loads of promotion for the film whenever he could. You definitely feel the love Christopher Lee has for the scripts all the way through.
And yeah, definitely.
Even like other ones recently, like I mentioned earlier, I went to see the film in cinema like before recording this podcast, and before the actual screening of the film, they had like a recording of an event done at Picture House Central in London on the 1st of May, which was a proper like, full 50th anniversary screening of the film, which had like live music and interviews with cast and crew of the film and some like well, notable fans like Reece Shearsmith. And one of the interviews they did was with Britt Eklund. And I think, Eklund was mentioned now, like, a while ago. I think he said it was the Empire Awards, having a chat with Christopher Lee about their experience in the film. And he definitely, even, like, up until recently, at the time when they did that ceremony, Lee's love of the film was had never waned.
I'd say the Blu-ray I was watching, he's on a lot of the extras, and he's just, raves and raves about it.
Yeah, I did the commentary, if I remember right, with the one that Mark Kermode hosted.
Yes, yeah, he's on there.
Yeah, it's really works for like this scene as well as along with the like earlier scene of Lord Summerisle's more proper introduction and his talk with Howie in his manner, and it's these kind of scenes played with each other that show more really complex character with Lord Summerisle and the question of how much he actually believes, how much he's playing it up, how much, because he knows that it wasn't the religion that was the reason for the crops to grow, and that's all things how he uses to try and rail against the residents of Summerisle in this scene, saying that Summerisle knows it's the reason the fruits explosive was because they're specific strains designed for the environment, not because of the folklore, but it's that question of how much he's come to believe that the religion was the reason for the strings working in the first place, how much he's playing it on. And yeah, it's a really interesting idea of how aware and accepting of it Lord Summerisle is, and Lee delivers that kind of dual nature of the character really well.
Yeah, it has like an ambiguity about it. It's intriguing, I guess. It keeps you thinking.
And yeah, then we also get to that bit when Howie is during his last of the Summerisle, saying that if the sacrifice in the rest of Summerisle fails and the fruits don't bloom again, that's the only sacrifice that will be worthy of the gods will be Lord Summerisle himself. And you get that little flicker of fear in Lee of what would happen if the crops fail again, and it's real after that point that his performance becomes a bit more stern and harsh, as in you can definitely feel that bit from Howie rattles him, and he's desperately trying wants to rationalise that it's going to work to avoid the potentially being sacrificed the next year.
I think as well, just quickly going back to you mentioned about the religious side of that scene as well, at the very beginning as well, visually there's some clear kind of Christ-like symbolism because they're holding his arms back, so it almost looks like he's being crucified. And also what he's wearing, those robes that he wears, have a kind of a biblical kind of simplicity about them. On top of the way that kind of Lord Summerisle talks about how he'll be a martyr, again, which is like Jesus, really. So there's a lot of obvious Christ-like symbolism at the beginning.
And yeah, definitely feel like there is part of the way to try and keep Howie calm, and they kind of want Howie to view it in the way they view it as an honour.
Yeah.
Saying that they're giving him a martyr's death and he'll be alongside the great saints, and they would feel that it's an honour. And if you feel this is the point where you can't stand the fact, you do turn against the residents and because they are going to kill him. Mm. But you can kind of get the idea of where they're coming from based on how we've seen the religion throughout the film.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I guess to them, it's, yeah, the way they view life and death is different to ours. It's, as I say, that's one of the reasons I quite like the film. It's about how it explores this kind of, I don't know if it is paganism or some kind of offshoot from paganism or something like that, but it obviously has a bit of that in there. Yeah, and it's, although they do mess up things, you can kind of appreciate where they're coming from in some ways. So, very unusual.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's definitely one, like, especially in terms of how the different influences they've taken for the film, like, there's stuff like paganism, Celtic mythology, even stuff like the Commedia dell'arte of Italy. It's all kind of like a bit of a mishmash of all these different iconographies and elements of folklore. And it's how different, feels like it's a unique form of pagan worship to this island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was trying to read in my notes somewhere, they were talking about, yeah, I think watching the extras, they're saying that the image of the Wicker Man is actually just taken from one sentence in Julius Caesar's account of his wars in what's now called France. Whereas, yeah, as you say, a lot of the other stuff's taken from all over the place.
I think that is like the only like record of like, you know, that's the traditional pagan Wicker Man. Like, then there were some different variations or types of it in like the 18th, 19th century, but really it was that description from Caesar, and really the Wicker Man only really became that more known figure of iconography because of this film.
Yeah, like, yeah. Stuff,
and even like to now, different things have, from form of culture, have taken influence from the Wicker Man, and the iconography is definitely based on this film. Stuff like, even like outside of film or TV, like the Alton Towers theme park here in the UK, they've got their roller coaster Wicker Man.
Oh really? I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Is there a Wicker Man festival? I'm making that up completely as well.
I know there's Burning Man festival.
Oh, I'm thinking of that. I think you're thinking of that.
And yeah, say again, more of like kind of iconography got more of its roots from this film.
Yeah.
And yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good way to segue into the actual reveal of the Wicker Man itself. And I love how it does the right kind of build up for the Wicker Man. Like, we see how we're getting dragged to it. And I think what really works is seeing Howie's reaction first. You get that sudden zoom in, that, oh God, oh Jesus Christ. And because I think that's the first time Howie's used like the Lord's name in that way in the film to show just how terrifying it must be to him. And then we get the reveal of the Wicker Man far away, and it's as we follow Howie, and it slowly builds up to the Wicker Man. It's that looming sense of inevitability that we get throughout this scene, the build up that makes it so effective as a horror scene.
Yeah, yeah, you just know he's getting in there, and it has that slow. It uses music again. It has that kind of monotonous drum beat as they slowly make their way up there. They really take the time getting up there, and the a lot of the editing kind of matches the drum beat, not entirely, but there's quite a few chunks where it does match the monotonous dun dun, just to really really draw out the tension, and again the kind of inevitability of it. It's a really impressive bit of production time. I mean, this is a low budget film, and it's huge, and they made it. It's not like they can't really fake it. They just had to go and make this giant Wicker Man, and and they've got all the animals and stuff shoved in the top of it. And I think there's a nice kind of story, and I think it was on the commentary or something like that, saying that Hardy went in with Woodward to discuss the scene, and the goat sat above the like weed on the head, supposedly, whilst they were doing some prep. So yeah, it can't have been very pleasant. And also the accounts of Woodward, is he said the whole shooting the whole scene was just terrifying, because although there was obviously an element of safety there, and there's it's still just the whole idea of it, and they did have fire around it. Obviously, they didn't set the Wicker Man itself on fire, but there was fire very close to it.
And then also again, it's the 1970s, and definitely not as the safety standards would have been as stringent as they would be today.
Yeah, not on a low budget film like that. No.
Well, it was interesting how I was looking at some details of the actual construction of it, and thinking how they actually design of it needs to in this like scale models first, and then actual scaling it up to the full size Wicker Man. Mm. And it's just amazing that they're actually able to do it so they could stand up, because it's definitely feel like designers, there was that risk of it being like too top heavy or not being structurally sound enough for like to hold like Edward Woodward or the animals, and there's the risk of it all just collapsing in on itself.
Yeah, was it the Shetland Islands or something like that? It's windy out there.
Yeah,
and they're up on the cliffs. It's absolutely, it's been terrifying.
So yeah, definitely was. I was reading stuff from the book Inside the Wicker Man, and talk about how they had to like change the shooting schedule for the actual filming of the scenes with the Wicker Man because like his given this, it's just going to talk about more in the next episode when they actually is on fire. You've only really got one chance to do it. I know they built two Wicker Men for contingency. Stuff like that. So you wouldn't just have one.
No, and they got lucky with the weather, supposedly, because they had horrendous weather the whole time. They're shooting in like autumn and winter. It's freezing, but it's supposed to be May. So they got really lucky for the endings. Obviously, it's they get this is towards the end of the scene. This might be the next minute, to be honest. But obviously you start to get the sunset. But also, I guess that's more the next minute. Yeah. Next 5 minutes, sorry.
And she got lucky because they were getting like reports from meteorologists, and they got the schedule of when they were actually shooting the scenes with the Wicker Man. They had one day in the middle of their shooting when the weather would be just the right conditions for filming it, so they had to change the whole schedule so in order to get that scene, to get all the scenes inside the Wicker Man and the burning of it done on that day, to make sure that they got all the footage they needed before the weather took a turn for the worst. And also interesting with how it would have affected, like, definitely with the performances and how, even like the length of the lines. So we get the bit when Howie's inside a Wicker Man and he's doing like another condemnation of the residents of Summer Isle. And I don't know if you noticed, like, some of the Edward Woodward's accounts is that he wasn't able to fully learn his lines for it because his intention was to get that all in his mind, his memory, the night before the film was meant to take place. But because they changed the schedule, he didn't have time to properly learn it. So according to Woodward's account, they had like massive cue cards set up so that he'd like read all the dialogue and deliver it that way. Granted, that's just Woodward's account. For like Robin Hardy and some of the other members of the crew, they don't have the same recollection, and there's no actual evidence of that being the case. But you can definitely buy that's how it was filmed in that way.
Possibly, as I say, especially if they only had a limited time to kind of get it done and could only do it once, then I guess it's feasible. I did notice in the extras there's quite a few little stories that aren't always corroborated. Like, so it's always a bit of a mystery who to believe. Because I think it was Woodward as well talking about an earlier scene. They had people moving the trees to keep up with the tracking shot, but no one else seems to agree with that. So maybe he's just imagining a lot of stuff.
Yeah, or maybe like it's if people have like different memories or
it's a long time ago.
Remembering one thing, maybe just like or maybe just remember like a little thing of like something being moved, and in his mind it's like conflated with something else, and you see like how the memory can play tricks on you.
Mentioning briefly the design as well, I saw an interview with the production designer, and talking about coming up with the Wicker Man. And I think at first, for a long time, he was going by that picture, the Julius Caesar account one. He kept trying to give it a face, and he just couldn't get it right and couldn't get it right. And obviously, eventually went with a faceless one, which I'm so glad they did, because the idea of having a face, I just don't know how it could have ever worked. It's so much more kind of menacing just being faceless and just a figure. It's like the whole kind of the Halloween films and a lot of the slasher films is having that kind of faceless where you can't really see the kind of soul of the character. Yeah. It just makes it more eerie. And just the idea of having a big smiley, kind of smiley-faced Wicker Man, like in the drawing, I think would have just been comical, really.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, the stuff I heard was, right, was that little plan of it being eyes made of daisies.
Mm, yeah.
And, well, yeah, I mean, if definitely imagine it done like that, it almost sounds farcical. It probably would have destroyed, like, the impact of the film if it...
Yeah.
Because people would have just laughed at it. Having Absolutely. It be this faceless, expressionless figure... It's, yeah, and then especially again, given and said how the camera moves up towards the Wicker Man, it helps make it this more imposing figure. Yeah, but then, and also, in terms of that, also with the design, is being, as I mentioned, it's the structural stability. And actually, one of the things they did to make sure that it could stand up was they actually dug a trench. On the cliffside and partially buried the Wicker Man so that it had a bit more of a stable base to it. At this point, where even after the scene was filmed, the legs were still present there for quite a few years afterwards. I mean, definitely up to like the 90s and 2000s, and so that became like a bit of a pilgrimage site for fans of the film was to. You find the legs and get your bit pictures of it. And I believe the story given in the book Inside the Wicker Man is that on one day, someone just drove their car up to the cliffs, put a rope around the legs and drove off with them.
Yeah, exactly. I can remember in the Mark Kermode documentary on the disc, they're still there and he just showed them. I didn't hear about someone nicking. Well, I was going to mention, actually, so it's kind of a surprising... cutaway in the scene, actually. Just before they start walking up, it cuts that shot of the moon over the "In the name of God, think what you're doing" line, and then it cuts the crashing waves. It's quite an odd. I don't know whether it needed to be done to kind of separate into the next portion. Maybe they couldn't quite. Maybe there were different locations. It was tricky to go straight into them. But I guess it also brings into those natural elements that are key to the island's kind of beliefs. But it's quite an interesting little addition there, I thought, when watching the 5 minutes. I guess the crashing waves add a bit of drama too. It's always nothing more dramatic than crashing waves on the side.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like you said, feel like that's essentially the stuff we've seen in the like previous section of the film of the like, constant shots of the cliffs and the waves crashing into it. And definitely see it as how the rest of Summer Island. They view what they're doing it for, like viewing it as part of their sort of nature and their relationship with nature and like the sexual sacrifice being that kind of symbiotic relationship for them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a nice little touch, just bringing, kicks off the start of the monotonous drum beats moving up to the Wicker Man itself.
And yeah, and then also as we get the scene goes on and the sun slowly setting behind the Wicker Man and Woodward, and you also get that extra little feel of the lingering sense of doom as it's getting darker and darker throughout the film.
Yeah.
In this section, because the majority of the film is in like broad daylight and
it's almost a countdown timer sort of thing, isn't it? Along with the drumming, it's yeah, that sun setting.
Yeah, definitely, and definitely as it goes on and the viewing the relationship of the sun in terms of how it's positioned in the sky as making sure they do that sacrifice at so it's like the right time for it to be most acceptable to the sun god for them.
Yeah, and I guess it's also symbolic of the end of life. I guess it's the end of the day, the end of life, the end of light. It all ties in together quite nicely, I guess.
And yeah, then also yeah, that those extra shots of the residents of Summer Isle surrounding the Wicker Man itself, and how he's seen around it, and it does add more to that ritualistic aspect of it.
Yeah, they're quite imposing. Even when, well, we only get a tiny bit of this in this 5 minutes, but they after the drumming stops, after he's in there, they just start to change from chanting to singing, don't they? But you just kind of miss it in this 5 minutes. You'll get more in the next one. But they bring in their usual folky style singing.
Yeah, I mean, you get a little bit this right at the end, because like the very very last bit of this section of the film, and actually a pretty good way for this section of the podcast to end, is the actual Lord Samrao giving the order for the Wicker Man to be burned, and
dropping his arm.
Yeah, and we see like the torches being like placed into the Wicker Man, and it's, and this is another point where I want to bring up, I hate doing this because it means I have to talk about it, but it's bringing up the remake again. And I think in another instance where the remake just didn't get the tone right, because in the remake, it's the remake's version of Rowan that lights the Wicker Man on fire, and you know, so the film is that the version of Rowan is Nicolas Cage's character's daughter, and so they try and have that more personal aspect to the burning of the Wicker Man, trying to create a sense of tragedy in that area, but it doesn't work for me. It kind of robs it of the ritualistic aspects of it, the kind of sense of duty that the residents of Summerisle in this original one have for doing it, that it's a necessary aspect of the religion for them, and there's no real sense of malice that they have to it. Whereas the remake, it does feel like it's more designed to be like an extra form of torture for Nicolas Cage's character that is done in that way, and the choice of who does the sets it on fire.
Yeah, I must admit I've not seen it. I think the reputation's so bad. I've just, well, part of me wants to watch it in a kind of car crash way, but I just, but at the same time, it's the reputation. It just feels so weird and miscast, and just an unusual choice of film to remake in America. And but yeah, by the way you're describing it, it just sounds like they just didn't get the film at all. It's it does sound like an atrocity. One of these days I might go for it, but no, I haven't seen it yet.
And it's still the real way to watch it is either morbid curiosity or for the memes.
I've heard about the bees sort of bit, but I will watch it one of these days.
And again, another aspect of why I don't think the remake works is like the not the bees scene is, well, in the remakes, well, firstly, it's only in the director's cut of the remake, so get that. But by doing it that way and having Howie be like tortured and knocked unconscious before we've seen the Wicker Man, and he wakes up at the feet of the Wicker Man, you get that instant looming shot of it. In the remake, you lose the slow build of the original, and I mean, as much as I love Nicolas Cage, he gets the line wrong. He doesn't deliver the line right, the oh god line. Like, Cage's version sounds more kind of bored to me when he delivers it, whereas Woodward, it's genuine, feels like genuine fear and dread and panic when he delivers that line.
Yeah, and he sells the fact that he's a religious man as well. It's not just a simple kind of exclamation to him. I think he is kind of pleading to God almost because of his beliefs. I think he sells that just subtly through the way he says it.
Yeah, there's that constant reprise of it as he's being dragged towards the Wicker Man. He feels like, again, he's desperately pleading for God to save him.
Yeah, and again, that's another reason I mentioned this earlier about why I think this scene's extra, kind of gives it extra powers. The fact that the rest of the film, he's so buttoned up and kind of stick up his bum sort of thing. Yeah. He's here he finally loses it, and it's kind of shocking to see him change like this after being so straight laced all the time and so kind of proper and neat. He's always got his uniform buttoned up straight. Other than one or two key scenes, obviously there's the Britt Eklund banging on the wall scene where he starts to lose his cool a little bit. But here he's gone. He's kind of, yeah, he's finally gone over.
And yeah, again, as I mentioned before, it's like for every scene on Summer Isle, aside from when he's in the pub and he's sleeping, and when he's caught, and when he actually gets pressed from his Mr. Punch, or when he's caught, he's always in full uniform at all times on Summer Isle.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Again, have that contrast of the more uptight, reserved Howie with full uniform, whereas Howie's in, like, what's it called? It's like a shift, or that's what it's called?
Yeah,
like the robe. Like that. And that sense of dread and panic that Howie has in that, it's that really effective contrast between Howie throughout the film, and the other reason that makes it this such an effective horror scene.
Yeah, absolutely. My only negative thing I would say about this scene is mainly just this one quick moment when he's rattling the door. It doesn't look particularly sturdy, the little door. Like, in my mind, he could probably get out quite easily, but at the same time, there's so many people around him, it's not like he'd get anywhere. But it does look a bit flimsy, that door.
Yeah, I mean, there's extra structure there that we don't see, but. Maybe. But yeah, it definitely feels like he's just definitely seeing it from the outside. It does look like it's just held together with a bit of string.
Yeah, I guess the wicker and the wood and stuff, if you put it the right way, it can be pretty sturdy. There's just one bit where you kind of rattle the door and it's like proper light flaps around. But yeah.
But then also there'd be like a pretty significant drop after out, so he'd probably like break his leg.
Yeah, into fire. I don't know if it's gone by then yet, but yeah. Yeah, plus you've got that big guy still hanging around and like hundreds of people around him. Yeah. So no, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, probably just, even if he got out, they'd probably catch him and just throw him right back in.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we finish, is there any other things you want to talk about with just sort of this scene in general or the film as a whole?
There's some very iconic, we've picked obviously the most iconic moment of the film. But there's also quite a few iconic lines as well. I think we've mentioned them kind of already. There's the "Oh God, Oh Jesus Christ," but there's also the kind of I want to call it a trailer line where you've got that "It's time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man."
Yeah, and as people who listen to this podcast know, that's the line I've been using to open every episode with.
It's an excellent episode to be on, so I'm quite pleased I got this one. Yeah, you do get to see the sunset shot in this. I've covered a lot of what I've written down here. I think just as I say. Generally, I just want to reiterate how I kind of really appreciate the film a lot more this time, different ways, in ways I wasn't expecting. It's definitely one of a kind, as I say.
Yeah, I definitely feel like it's one where, for quite a few people, it's one where it's sort of the second viewing, or especially when the director's cut and the final cut came out and we got that kind of better pacing and flow and the extra song and the moving of like Willow's Dance from the first night to the second night. All those little changes that make it flow better in the dress code final cut as compared to the theatrical cuts.
Yeah. I was going to ask, actually, which cut have you been using for this podcast? I never thought to ask.
For this podcast, I've been using the final cut. So it's my personal preferred version of the film. Yeah. Like, I think I mentioned it before, but like the theatrical cut, there's too much missing from it. It's probably one of my favourite scenes and probably most totally important scenes for me in the film, which is Howie's first night in the pub and seeing with the song "Gently Johnny." That's missing in the theatrical cut. So
yeah.
I've definitely wanted a version of the film that had that song in it. But the director's cut feels a bit more baggy as compared to the final cut. I think the pacing in the final cut's just that little bit better.
Yeah. I must admit, I can't remember what the kind of newspaper version was. I assume it was theatrical, but I think it would have been when I got it. I think it might have been around when the director's cut was around, but I don't know. I kind of assume it will have been theatrical. So I don't think I've seen the director's cut. I didn't have a chance to watch them all, really. So, yeah, I was umming and ahhing which one to watch, because obviously the director's cut's longer, but most of the places I'd read had kind of preferred the final cut. And obviously because the director preferred the final cut, I figured that was the way.
I think it's worth watching, definitely doing at least one sort of watch of the director's cut for those in the last bit. Like mainly there's a full like prologue on mainland Scotland, a few minutes 5 minutes of the mainland before Howie gets in seaplane towards Summer Isle. So we get a bit of the initial backstory of Summer Isle there, and get the full letter of how he gets sent and stuff like that. You get those little hints of the perception of Summer Isle earlier on, and all different ideas of Howie's righteousness. But again, for me, having you just go straight to the island, and after in the final cut, see that bit of Howie in church.
Yeah, I was gonna say the final cut does have some before the island, doesn't it? But it's more montage-y almost. You just see him in church, and
but again, for me, just having that bit highlights that the main aspect of the film that's worth talking about is, and that's the main base of the film, is the religious conflict.
Yeah,
and having that bit is the right way to highlight it, because the theatrical cut has that scene, like stuff of Howie in church, only shown as flashback when Howie's staying in the pub. But yeah, the final cut having that be a little prologue, it works a bit better for pacing and setting up that tone right from the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's vital really to kind of get that in there. It's so important, the kind of religious side of the film. Yeah, so it does work better having it just front and center, definitely. That might be why, as I say, the first time I saw it, it's been a while since that first viewing, but I just didn't get as much from it. I think perhaps it was the cut I saw. Or it was me, I was younger, I was less clued up, I don't know.
Or could just be because you were watching, given the position of newspapers, absolute god-awful quality.
Yeah, it was on this tiny hotel TV, and I was very tired and probably not concentrating as hard as I should have either.
Yeah, I guess it was like an old CRT.
Oh, yeah, I think it probably was.
So, yeah, is there any other things you want to talk about?
No, I think, as I say, I think we've covered it pretty well. It's, excellent scene, excellent film.
So, yeah, with that, we've come to the end of episode 17, and next week's episode 18, is going to be the final main episode talking about the actual scene-by-scene look at the film. Maybe carry it on in some form in the future, but see what happens. I'd like to thank David again for being guests on this podcast.
Okay, it's a pleasure. I enjoyed myself.
And before we get going, is there anything that you want to plug?
Well, yeah, if you just head over to my website at blueprintreview.co.uk, and where we review mainly home entertainment releases with physical media guys, but we cover other bits and pieces. But yeah, it tends to reviews of your boutique Blu-ray releases and UHDs and things. You head over there.
I mean, definitely, it's definitely good to see media reviews on like the boutique Blu-rays. definitely agree with everyone's on some and seeing all the specs. Like, I definitely remember when reading your review of the Second Sight bumper box set of Dawn of the Dead, and
oh yeah, that was an epic. That's one of my longest reviews. Yeah, like yeah, that was a beast.
Yeah, and yeah, because I've got that Blu-ray set, and it's one of probably the best collector's edition Blu-ray I've got.
Oh, it's insane. Yeah, there's so much on there. It's phenomenal, and it's all good. Like sometimes I find some discs when they put a lot on, there's a lot of repetition. You hear the same kind of stories, and it's almost a less is more can sometimes be better. But with that, there's a lot, you still find new things to learn about in each commentary and each documentary, and I loved it. I can remember just digging through all that material for a while. It was fantastic.
Yeah,
and I must say, actually, The Wicker Man, I was really impressed by that. I enjoyed working through that set too. It was and again, I love the fact that it had the soundtrack on there. I think it's a nice addition. I think more films should do that. I'm a big soundtrack guy. So I wish more labels would do that. It does happen now and again.
That's why I brought up Dawn of the Dead. I think the only ones definitely that I've got that have done that are The Wicker Man and Dawn of the Dead.
Well, there's a couple. I'm trying to think. I've had a couple more. The Arrow and the Shawscope sets, they come with soundtracks. They're like collections of, because they use library music a lot in those films, but they have a collection of those. And Arrow also did that with the Jodorowsky set they did, which was awesome. Those soundtracks are cool. And I believe Radiance, which is a new label on the block, which are looking to be a really, really good label. I think they're doing that with at least one of their releases with The Dead Mother, I think it's called. I think they're doing that with that. So hopefully they're more, it's becoming a little bit more of a minor trend that will catch on. But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. This is always nice to have those little extra bits.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for me, you can find my main site over at cooksreviews.wordpress.com. You can like reviews of recent releases. And then you can follow me on Twitter at Tony Cooks, on Instagram at CookingTony. So yeah, I'd like to thank David again for being guest on this week's episode.
Thank you, no worries.
And to everyone listening, I'll see you again next time.